Hi, and welcome to Halfwit History. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Kylie.
And this is a show where we talk about the upcoming week, but a long time ago.
And sometimes not so long ago.
Yeah. What do we got this week? We got any updates?
I don't have any. Do you?
Neither do I.
Okie dokie. Alrighty then, jumping right in. So this episode is the week of May 24th through the 30th. And my event happens on May 24th, but I'm not going to tell you when.
Ha. You sneaky.
Well, you'll find out soon enough.
I mean, I just did the exact same thing. I think we actually have kind of a history of not telling each other what the topic is for a little bit.
We have to keep some things mysterious.
Yeah. End of sentence. Nothing more.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So this week I want to talk about probably the best known nursery rhyme in the English language. Can you guess what it is?
Hot cross buns.
No. It's Mary Had a Little Lamb.
That was definitely my next guess.
And did you know that the original poem was authored by a woman who lived in Boston?
No, but it honestly doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, right. Her name was Sarah Josepha Hale, and she did so much more than just writing children's poetry. She was an American writer, activist, and an influential editor, as well as one of the influential people behind the creation of Thanksgiving.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, as a national holiday, it already existed, like, as a concept.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, Sarah Josepha Hale was born October 24th, 1788, in Newport, New Hampshire. Her parents were Captain Gordon Buell, a Revolutionary War veteran, and Martha Wittesley Buell. Luckily for Sarah, her parents believed that girls had just as much right to an education as boys, and she was homeschooled with her mother and her older brother, Horatio, what a name, who had attended Dartmouth. So he helped with his schooling his siblings when he was home,
cool.
Which is nice. So she became a school teacher once she was old enough, sharing her knowledge with the local children. And in 1811, her father opened a tavern called the Rising Sun in Newport. And that same year, Sarah met a lawyer named David Hale. And I'm sure you can tell from the last name what happens next. They married. Oh, no. They married at her father's tavern on October 23rd.
Married at the tavern?
Yep.
Nice. These are cool people.
In 1813, on October 23rd, which so like the day before her birthday, which I thought was just funny. And over the course of their marriage, they would have five children. David, born in 1815. Horatio, born in 1817. Francis, born in 1819. Sarah, born in 1820. And William, born in 1822. Sadly, David Hale died in 1822. I think they were only married for what? 9 years?
Yeah.
And Sarah would wear black for the rest of her life as a sign of mourning for her beloved husband. In 1823, Sarah published her first collection of poems titled The Genius of Oblivion with the financial help of her late husband's Freemason Lodge. And then 4 years later, in 1827, Sarah's first novel was published in the U.S. under the title Northwood, Life North and South, and then in London under the title A New England Tale. The novel made Sarah one of the first novelists to write a book about slavery, as well as one of the first American women novelists. Reverend John Blake praised Northwood and asked Hale to move to Boston to serve as the editor of his journal, titled The Ladies Magazine. She took him up on that offer and served as she took the title editress, so like she made it feminine, yeah, of The Ladies Magazine from 1828 to 1836, and is believed to have been the first magazine edited by a woman.
Oh,
so
cool.
That's cool. Yeah. Sarah hoped the magazine would help in educating women writing, quote, not that they may usurp the situation, but encroach on the prerogatives of man, but that each individual may lend her aid to the intellectual and moral character of those within her sphere. So not a full blown feminist, but remember, this is the early 1800s.
You can only ask for so much.
I know. But definitely it was a step in the right direction. Her collection of poems for our children, which includes Mary Had a Little Lamb, which was originally titled Mary's Lamb, was published on May 24th, 1830. And that is our topic.
There we go.
Yeah. In 1833, Sarah became the founding president of the Seamen's Aid Association that was made to assist the surviving families of Boston sailors who died at sea. And it was affiliated with the Boston Port Society, and the woman of the Seamen's Aid Society operated a clothing store called the Mariner's House, a boarding house for seamen, and a free school for Mariners' daughters in Boston's North Square.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I like the part about a school exclusively for girls in 1830s? I think that's pretty cool.
Especially for sailors, girls.
Yeah, because that's not upper class. That, like, it's not women who would need to learn, like, reading and whatever to impress their influential husbands.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it is
much more commoner, which is nice to see that kind of support.
Yeah, yeah. She was, her, like, main cause was women's education.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of activists have, you know, like, one, like, very core cause.
Well, you have to have a focus or else you can't accomplish anything.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you, like, it's just there's so much you can't do it all.
Right.
So her thing was women's education.
I was also slightly going for the fact that you are a daughter of a sailor.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I could have gone to that school. Hey, there we go. Anyway, in 1867, the society merged with the Boston Port Society to form the Boston Port and Seamen's Aid Society. So just tacking all of the names together.
Mm-hmm.
And as a weird little link to my life, beyond the one that you mentioned earlier, the organization of one of the archives that I used to work for, which I will not name, dated back far enough that they actually had monetary, like, bequeathments and, like, stipulations from wills that specifically requested their, like, donation to be used, like, from that organization to help with the Seamen's Aid Society.
Oh, that's neat.
Which, and then, like, as things merged and that wasn't as big of a thing as it had been, they were kind of like, how do we still follow the, like, requirements of this will? Because, like, you can't deviate.
Right.
But there's all this money that's sitting there untouched because technically this thing doesn't, you know, like, it changed names, it changed functions, you know, whatever the main purpose was no longer technically exists.
Right.
So what do we do with this money that's just sitting here, and how do we, like, figure out how to reallocate it so it still follows the, like, intent of the will, even if it's not, like, the letter of the will? It's a fun time, guys. Don't work in that. It's awful.
Okay.
Anyway. So, fun fact, the Mariner's House is actually still active today as an inexpensive hotel for merchant mariners on active duty. It offers short-term accommodations, a maximum of 13 days. So, not quite 2 weeks, but I guess I think a lot of the time, like, if you're in between, like, what's it called? Being on the ship and not, I feel like,
I want to say deployment, but I know that's not right.
Technically, it's not.
Tours? In between tours?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. One of my really good friends from...
A three-hour tour.
Not Gilligan's Island, sweetie. One of my really good friends, her dad was a merchant marine. So, like, but his was like 6 months on, 6 months off kind of thing.
Yep.
So it was like a much bigger, but I'm assuming that if you're, you know, going for shorter voyages, maybe you're in between.
Voyages, that's a good word.
Your in-between time is less. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just pulling things out of thin air. But the rate started at $65, including breakfast for guests who could prove that they were actively working in the merchant marine. So that's in this day and age, that is cheapo.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. In 1836, the Ladies' Magazine, which had been renamed the American Ladies' Magazine, to specifically differentiate it between it from the Ladies' Magazine of London.
Okay.
Because it had to be American.
That's right.
Okay.
America.
But the American Ladies' Magazine was acquired by Louis Antoine Goody, the owner of Goody's Ladies' Books, out of Philadelphia. In 1837, Goody merged American Ladies' Magazine with his own journal, and Sarah continued on as the editor for the expanded journal, but insisted that she edit from Boston while her youngest son, William, attended Harvard College. So now a connection to my current job. Hey!
Look at all these connections.
She remained the editor of Goody's for 40 years, retiring in 1877 when she was 89.
That's a good stint.
Yeah. That's insane. And she did end up moving to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, once her son graduated. So her, like, papers and stuff are, I think, at the Athenaeum in Philadelphia, if anyone wants to check those out.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's the kind of position that I really want, one that I would love enough to work until I'm nearly 90. Not that I'm going to work that long, but I'm saying that I want that kind of job that I love that much, you know?
I would love to be an 89-year-old still podcasting these stories to you.
I wonder how long... I mean, I guess you'd never really run out of topics, but I feel like they'd probably get pretty boring as time went on.
I don't know. There's a lot of history, Kylie. We just got to be better at finding it.
That is true. Also, you know, when we're 89, we'll have almost a century of history that we can now touch.
Oh, man.
That we couldn't before.
That we can just talk about from life. I don't want to think about this. Keep talking. Back to topic.
As Jonathan's life flashes before his eyes. So, during Sarah's time as editor of Goodies, the issues contained poetry, articles, and engravings created by prominent writers and other artists of the time, including the likes of Nathaniel Hawthorne, Washington Irving, Edgar Allan Poe, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Longfellow, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Lucretia Mott, and Susan B. Anthony.
You know, I think I recognize at least a few of those names.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
I recognize all of them. The student of history and women's feminism that I am. The last two are feminists. You probably don't know Lucretia Mott, but you know Susan B. Anthony.
You know, I am aware. That was more of a joke as to how famous all those names are.
Yeah, well, I kind of weeded out the ones that I was like, I don't think anyone's going to know who these people are. Because I'm the worst. Anyway. Although the magazine was read and contained work by both men and women, Sarah published three special issues that only included work done by women. So she made a point to really highlight those, which I think is very nice.
Yes.
When she first began editing for Goodies in 1837, the magazine had a circulation of 10,000 subscribers. 2 years later, it jumped to 40,000. And by 1860, had 150,000 subscribers.
Wow.
The largest readership of any journal in its day.
Wow.
And it was technically a ladies' journal.
Nice.
Yeah, that's really awesome. So during this time, she became one of the most important and influential arbiters of American taste. And she used some of her influence to further several causes for women, including creating a regular section with the heading Employment for Women, beginning in 1852 to discuss women in the workforce.
Cool.
Yeah. The magazine is also credited with an ability to influence fashions, not only for women's clothing. The magazine is also credited with an ability to influence fashions, not only for women's clothes, but also in domestic architecture, publishing house plans that were copied from by home builders nationwide. So like home construction and design.
Yeah, pretty influential.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. The more I read about this, the more I was like, wow, like this is pretty awesome. It reminds me of, like, the Sears, you could buy, like, house kits from Sears.
Oh, yeah, where it was, like, this whole, or like IKEA, where it's, like, here's the whole room that you're going to plop down into your pop-up house that we also sell.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. My aunt and uncle have a house across from them that is one of those Sears, like you buy the parts and, like, you put together the house, essentially.
Yep.
And, like, it's being cleaned out, and they're just, like, sitting there laughing because like they're just taking dumpster and dumpster and dumpster of stuff out of this house.
Jeez.
To the point where they filled up one dumpster and it sank.
Oh.
Like a foot into the ground.
Oh.
And then the truck that was supposed to remove it sank. Like the back end sank into the ground like halfway and another truck had to come and pull it out.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. So, under Sarah's leadership, Goodies published the works of Catherine Beecher and Emma Willard and other early advocates of education for women. She called for play and physical education as important learning experiences for children, writing, quote, "physical health and its attendant cheerfulness promote a happy tone of moral feeling, and they are quite indispensable to successful intellectual effort." She became an early advocate for women's higher education and helped to found Vassar College. Ever heard of it?
No, actually. Oh, God, I'm not lying.
God damn. No, Jonathan. Crap.
This is called Halfwit History for a reason. And also, if you haven't figured it out by now, if you're listening backwards, I guess you wouldn't know. I am not a big fan of higher education institutions.
Yeah, well, you have your own personal issues there, buddy.
Anyways, I don't know what Vassar is. What is that?
It was originally a women's college, but it was like, it's a very prominent women's college.
Cool.
Yeah. She wrote 17 articles and editorials about women's education and helped make founding an all-women's college acceptable to a public that didn't really know what to do with the idea of women in higher education, like for real.
Uh-huh.
In 1860, the Baltimore Female College awarded Hale a medal, quote, for distinguishing services in the cause of female education. Sarah also made significant efforts to uplift the historical memory of outstanding women. Among her 50-plus books were several editions of Women's Record Sketches of All Distinguished Women from the Creation to A.D. 1854. It originally published in 1855. So, like, basically a history of notable women.
Neat.
And it had 2,500 entries that made an encyclopedic effort to put women at the center of world history.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of entries. I mean,
it's a lot of women.
This is both a lot and also not nearly enough.
Yeah. But yeah. So like, that's awesome, but also kind of sad that it was only 20, like there were only 2,500. So take that as
I mean, it's a lot to put into a single publication.
Right. And it was like updated, so I think it had three editions. So like each time it was re-released, that more was added.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah. So that's neat. And then, you know, after she died, they didn't make any more of them. Anyway, you had to know it was coming. She was born in 1780 something.
No, I was saying wah wah to people abandoning her work.
Oh, well, yeah. So in the course of this ambitious project, she completed some 36 volumes of profiles of women, tracing their influence through history on social organization and literature.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of books. And that's a lot of research. So while Sarah pushed for women's education, she also tended to enforce pretty stereotypical gender roles. It was the mid-1800s, after all.
Mm-hmm.
And she argued that the woman was, quote, God's appointed agent of morality.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Sarah didn't push back against the traditional domestic roles for women, but tried to slowly expand on them. For example, she believed that women shaped the morals of society and pushed for women to write morally uplifting novels. So pushing women into a sphere where they were not generally accepted, aka authorship and publication, but still kind of making it palatable for men by keeping it to women things. There's a lot of sarcastic air quotes going on right now.
Yeah, and also like forcing women to be like positive and like not listening to their hysterics.
Yeah.
Is essentially what I'm hearing right there.
Yeah. So it was trying to push in the right direction, but not really breaking boundaries.
Yeah, steps.
Yeah.
You got to have steps to everything. It should be quicker than that, but
you kind of got to crawl before you can run, but don't spend your whole life crawling.
Yeah.
So she wrote that, quote, while the ocean of political life is heaving and raging with the storm of partisan passions among the men of America, women, as the true conservators of peace and goodwill, should be careful to cultivate every gentle feeling. She did not, however, support the women's suffrage movement, which I kind of found a little surprising, considering she published a lot of stuff from notable suffragists, aka Lucretia Mott and Susan B. Anthony.
Well, I feel like you answered your own question, like, last sentence, where it was like, she wanted women to be more involved in things, but she also very much was like, traditional gender roles. And part of that could very easily be, women shouldn't vote.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Especially because it's like, women should only be doing happy things. And would you consider voting to spark joy?
Does it spark joy?
Yeah.
We're not Marie Kondoing this woman. Mm-hmm. So
she's not sparking joy anymore.
Oh, no.
Goodbye.
Oh, no. Poor Sarah. So she believed more in the, quote, secret silent influence of women to sway male voters. So, like, you know, the woman behind the man kind of idea, which was pretty, you know, pretty well accepted that that was like the root of women's power at that time, was their influence over the men in their family.
Yeah, also kind of, you know, silly to, nonsense to relegate that, oh, this power that you have from the shadows is better than just having the power yourself. You know?
I fully do not agree with that. Again, I was a woman's suffrage, like, historian. That was my area of study in grad school. So, like, clearly this part I do not agree with. I see where she could be coming from, but I want more. So, but
needy,
you know,
needy.
I am. I demand respect. Anyway, so she appeared as a conservative who emphasized convention and promoted special and separate roles for women, and her opposition to suffrage alienated active feminists. She wanted to open up the professions, advising Vassar College to hire women instructors and administrators, and her success in publishing works by so many women enhanced the visibility of women authors. So she made some good steps and, you know, didn't make progress in other areas.
It sounds like she kind of inadvertently made some good steps and not... It almost is starting to sound not intentional, just like a... This is things that I want to do, so I'm going to do others and let make it easier for other women to do the things that I want to do.
Yeah, she had one area of passion and was very, very passionate about it, and that kind it sort of overflowed to other areas, but it was not intentional, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Sarah Josepha Hale was also one of the people responsible for making Thanksgiving a national holiday in the U.S. Fun fact, it had previously been celebrated mostly just in New England, where each state scheduled its own holiday, some as early as October, and others as late as January, and it was largely unknown in the southern states.
I 100% believe that.
Yeah, me too. Just states doing whatever they want, and then the South being like, what? Uh-huh. She began advocating for the national holiday in 1846, writing letters to Presidents Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan, and Lincoln. Her initial letters failed to persuade, but the letters that she wrote to Lincoln convinced him to support legislation establishing a national holiday of Thanksgiving in 1863, 17 years after she started her letter-writing campaign.
Jesus.
She was dedicated. The new national holiday was considered a unifying day after the division of the Civil War and became only the third national holiday after Washington's birthday and Independence Day.
Interesting.
So there's that claim to fame.
Mm-hmm.
Her persistence earned her the nickname the Mother of Thanksgiving. That's not what I want to be the mother of, sorry.
Not really.
So, in addition to being a proponent of Thanksgiving, Sarah was also key in preserving George Washington's Mount Vernon plantation as a symbol of patriotism that both the northern and southern United States could all support, supposedly. She also raised $30,000 in Boston for the completion of the Bunker Hill Monument.
Huh.
So, like, she found funds for a significant portion of it.
Yeah.
So the Bunker Hill Monument, if any of our listeners aspire to climb it, make it the start of your Freedom Trail expedition, not the end.
Yeah, I remember getting lots of angry texts from Kylie as she was doing that.
Yeah. 294 stairs may not seem like that much, but after 2.5 miles walking across Boston, yeah, don't do it. Make it the start, not the end. Uh-huh. I promise you will thank me. But back to funding the stairway to Quad Heaven. When construction...
You.
Yeah, that was great. When construction stalled, Sarah asked her readers to donate $1 each and also organized a week-long craft fair at Quincy Market. Described as Oprah and Martha Stewart combined, Sarah's organization of the giant craft fair at Quincy Market, quote, was much more than a bake sale. Refreshments were sold, but they brought in only a fraction of the profit. The fair also sold handmade jewelry, quilts, baskets, jams, jellies, cakes, pies, and autographed letters from Washington, James Madison, and the Marquis de Lafayette.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. In other words, my fantasy fair.
Uh-huh.
So Sarah Josepha Hale was awarded many other honors throughout both during her life and after her life, including the naming of Liberty Ship number 1583. Nope, 1538.
She named it Liberty Ship.
No, it was named after her, but it's no longer like commissioned.
I'm like, wow, good naming there, Sarah.
So like, I mean, you could say the Sarah Josepha Hale was named after her, but you wouldn't know what it was. It was a Liberty ship, which if you're in like the Navy or any sort of like naval adjacent,
you would understand
what ship is. Yeah. Anyway, 1538, not 1583. My member dyslexia is getting to me.
Uh-huh. I feel that.
But it was active from 1943 to 1972. A New York City Board of Education vocational high school on the corner of Dean Street and 4th Avenue in Brooklyn, New York.
Folk schools, woo!
Was also named in her honor, but it closed in June of 2001, so meh. There's also a prestigious literary award named after her, the Sarah Josepha Hale Award. Notable winners of the Hale Award include Robert Frost in 1956, Ogden Nash in 1964, Elizabeth Yates in 1970, Arthur Miller in 1990, and Julia Alvarez in 2017.
Very cool.
Yeah. She was also honored as the fourth in a series of historical bobblehead dolls created by the New Hampshire Historical Society.
Of course it's New Hampshire.
And sold in their museum store in Concord, New Hampshire.
Of course it's New Hampshire.
I need to go. She's also featured on a New Hampshire historical marker, number 6, along the New Hampshire Route 103 in Newport, which now I also want to drive by because, you know, let's make it a trip.
This is the most exciting trip we've ever talked about.
Honestly, yeah, probably.
Oh, my
I'm kidding. I got to stop at the bobblehead place and see some lady's marker on the highway. She was also honored with a feast day on the liturgical calendar of the Episcopal Church in the U.S. on April 30th, and she was commemorated on the Boston Women's Heritage Trail. So lots of awards and honors there. Okay, now back to the nursery rhyme for a real quick second.
Whoa, forgot about that
yep,
for a hot moment.
I know. I realized that I was doing my notes where I was like, that's going to be a hard reset, but hey.
Yep, here we are.
So for anyone interested, it's number 7,622 in the Round Folk Song Index, in case anyone cares. It's also, according to local lore, based on real events.
Interesting.
Ayo. So refresher, the rhyme goes as such. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. He followed her to school one day, that was against the rule. It made the children laugh and play to see a lamb at school. And so the teacher turned him out, but still he lingered near, and waited patiently about till Mary did appear. And then he ran to her and laid his head upon her arm, as if he said, I'm not afraid, you'll keep me from all harm. What makes the lamb love Mary so? The eager children cry. Oh, Mary loves the lamb, you know, the teacher did reply. And you each gentle animal in confidence may bind and make them follow at your call if you are always kind.
You know what? I don't think I've ever heard the entirety of Mary Has a Little Lamb.
I'm pretty sure I literally know the first stanza.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the story goes that when Sarah was teaching in a small school not far from her home in Newport, New Hampshire, she was surprised one morning to see one of her students, a girl named Mary, enter the classroom followed by her pet lamb. The visitor was far too distracting to be permitted to remain in the building, and so Sarah turned him out. The lamb stayed nearby till school was dismissed and then ran up to Mary looking for attention and protection. The other youngsters wanted to know why the lamb loved Mary so much, and their teacher explained it was because Mary loved her pet, hence the stanza about being kind to animals to gain their trust.
Mm-hmm.
In 1876, at the age of 70 years old, Mary Tyler, maiden named Sawyer, emerged to claim that she was the Mary from the poem. As a young girl, Mary kept a pet lamb that she took to school one day at the suggestion of her brother. Which is kind of random. Why would you tell your sister to take her pet to school?
Mean brother.
Yeah. Wanted her to get in trouble.
Yeah, Mary. Take your lamb to class.
Take your distracting pet to school.
That'll work out great, Mary.
Sounds like something I would have done to my brother. Anyway, love you, Luke.
Mom! Look what Mary did. I'm not in trouble anymore.
A commotion naturally ensued, and Mary recalled, quote, visiting school that morning was a young man by the name of John Rollstone, a nephew of the Reverend Lemuel Capon, who was then settled in Sterling. It was the custom then for students to prepare for college with ministers, and for this purpose, Rollstone was studying with his uncle. The young man was very much pleased with the incident of the lamb, and the next day he rode across the fields on horseback to the little old schoolhouse and handed me a slip of paper, which had written upon it the three original stanzas of the poem, end quote. Which implies that Sarah Hale didn't write the poem.
Plagiarism!
So there's literally no supporting evidence besides this woman's story. So as far as history is concerned, Sarah Josepha Hale did in fact publish this poem. So even though the claim lives on unsupported by evidence, multiple sites in the town of Sterling, Massachusetts perpetuate it. A 2-foot-tall statue and historical marker representing Mary's little lamb stands in the town center. The Redstone School, where Mary Sawyer attended school and purports the incident took place, was built in 1798, but was later purchased by Henry Ford and relocated to a churchyard on the property of Longfellow's Wayside Inn in Sudbury. So we could go on a little day trip. And In a related but odd fun fact, Mary Sawyer's house, located in Sterling, was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2000, but was destroyed by arson on August 12th, 2007. Womp womp.
2007. What a
2007.
Year.
2007. Hey now. In the 1830s, Lowell Mason set the nursery rhyme to a melody, adding repetition in the verses, becoming the nursery song that most of us grew up learning. Now, did you know that Mary Had a Little Lamb was the first audio recording by Thomas Edison on his newly invented phonograph in 1877?
No, I didn't. That's interesting.
Yeah. It was the first instance of recorded English verse following the recording of the French folk song Au Clair de la Lune by Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville in 1860.
I feel like you talked about that at some point.
That it was the first thing that was recorded, or the French folk song?
The French folk song. I feel like that got mentioned.
I did the Marseillaise.
No, I know, but for some reason, I feel like I've heard that before, and I should not know anything about France.
Well, I don't remember it, so who knows?
Totally.
In 1927, Edison reenacted the recording, which still survives. The earliest recording, 1878, was retrieved by 3D imaging equipment in 2012. Another little fun tidbit, the British version of the song changes the intonation of the last repeated line. So when Americans sing it, the third repetition of Little Lamb goes up, whereas the British keep it on the same note.
That sounds boring.
So, Mary had a little lamb, is what Americans do. And then British do like the Mary had a little lamb. I listened to it and I went, oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
Yeah, I was not a fan. But yeah, that's the story behind Mary Had a Little Lamb, also known as Mary's Lamb, and Sarah Josepha Hale. And of course, we're ending with my awful singing, so that was fun.
Good. We've ended with awful singing two episodes in a row now.
Oh no, you're right. Yeah, well, yeah, it was
we also discovered that we have this weird connection between a bunch of the recent episodes we did where Kylie ended on a fun fact about the mummy, and then she started the next episode
with a quote from the mummy,
which was about a librarian archaeologist, and then I just did an episode about archaeology
that ended
with singing, and you just ended this one with singing, and then my fun fact was about, you know, the ocean, when my topic was about a shipwreck, and then we ended with a song, and now this episode we're doing a song.
Yep.
Man, we are on a really weird roll right now.
I'll take it. Call to action?
Yeah. So if you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Halfwit History, and you can go to our website at www.halfwit-history.com, and you can shoot us emails at halfwitpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, if you have any comments, suggestions, feedback, topic suggestions, we would absolutely love to hear from you. Or, you know, even just to send us a little shout out that, hey, we helped you with your history paper.
Thanks again, Hannah.
Yeah, you get two shout outs now. Or you can also find we have a submission form pinned to the top of our Twitter for any topic submissions that you might have.
Yeah, and thank you to the Fishermen for the use of our theme song, Another Day. You can find a link to their SoundCloud down in our show notes, pointing down.
Yes. Fun facts.
Fun facts.
You get to go first, my good sir.
Yes, very exciting. I like going first. I'm going to keep talking so I can open the Google Drive.
You're a dummy.
Okay, my fun fact is on May 29th of 1987, the Twilight Zone director John Landis was found innocent of involuntary manslaughter in the death of actor Vic Morrow and two child actors during filming.
Oh, boy.
And I picked that one because I know just a little tidbit about that. Hmm. They were filming a scene with a helicopter, and the blades of the helicopter came down a little bit too far. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, you didn't need to tell me that part.
Oh, gosh.
Now I'm horrified.
About that.
Now my fun fact seems really cruel.
Oh, no. What inadvertent link did we make now?
No, well, I mean, it's kind of a long stretch, but I feel kind of bad about it.
Uh-oh.
Also on May 29th, interestingly enough, but 1912, 15 young women were fired by the Curtis Publishing Company in Philadelphia for dancing the turkey trot during their lunch break.
Not sure how it's related, but that's interesting.
It was more the neck turkey. I don't know.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Kylie. That is a stretch.
Well, you didn't get it.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Anyway, just end the show.
Don't slam the table. It makes the springs wobble. Well, anyways, that's been our show. As always, I've been your halfwit.
And I'm your historian.
And we hope to see you next week.
Bye.